The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Maimonides, Egyptian Jewry and the Muslim Revolution, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Chaim Yosef Reuven ben Pinchos Olav HaSholom, Mr. Joseph Toul of blessed memory.
With the exception of Eretz Yisrael, no place on earth is so central to Judaism as Mitzrayim, the land of Egypt. Every day, morning and night, we were required to mention the fact that we were slaves in Egypt and that Hashem took us out. Every Pesach, we commemorate that event and spend much time relating to our children the historic details of the slavery and the Exodus. In addition, the Torah in three places makes the point that we shall never return back there. The prohibition to live in Egypt is one of the Taryag, one of the 613 mitzvahs. How the Rambam, or any one of the other great Chachomim who lived in Egypt, were allowed to do so is a subject we will touch upon at the end of this lecture. The land of Egypt has also played an important role in Jewish history, the years following the Exodus. Almost 500 years after the Exodus, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, married an Egyptian princess, the daughter of one of the pharaohs. The Jewish nation was then at its zenith. The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, had just been built. There was a secure peace, and the Jewish state's influence spanned the globe. The Talmud, in Shabbos, Nunvav Amud Beis, 56b, attribute Shlomo HaMelech's decline, and with it the decline of the Jewish people, with his marriage to the Egyptian princess. In addition, in order to amply supply his army with horses, Shlomo HaMelech sent a group of Jewish trade officials back to Egypt. This was the first time in 500 years the Jews lived in Egypt. After Shlomo's death, the Egyptians sent a larger group back to Israel. This was an army under the pharaoh, under Paro Sheshach, that plundered the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, and emptied it of its treasures. After a silence of some 250 years, the land of Egypt comes up again in our history, with the last king of Yisrael, the northern kingdom of Israel, Hoshea ben Elah, who sent a delegation to the Egyptians in order to forge an alliance in a war against Assyria. The plan backfired, and Assyria soon sent the remnant of the kingdom of Israel into exile. These were the 10 lost tribes. Some 100 years passed, and once again Egypt again enters our history. This time, Egypt was involved with Yehuda, the southern kingdom of Israel. Pharaoh Parinacho, who was in the middle of a campaign against the Babylonians, killed the king of Yehuda, Yoshia HaMelech, who attempted to block his passage, and installed a new king. Yoshia's son, Yehoyachaz, was installed by Paro. 3 months later, Paro, Pharaoh, replaced him with Yehoyachaz's brother, Yehoyachim. A few years later, Babylon, under their king Nebuchadnezzar, conquered the area and wrested control of Yehuda from the Egyptians. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar had Yehoyachim killed, first installed Yehoyachim's son Yehoyachin, or Yechoniah, as king, and 3 months later replaced him with Yehoyachim's brother Tzidkiyahu. Tzidkiyahu was the last king of the Davidic line. But this is not the last we hear from Egypt. Tzidkiyahu finally revolted against Nebuchadnezzar, and the last-ditch effort to save his kingdom, tried to ally himself with Egypt, but to no avail. The temple was destroyed. The kingdom of Yehuda came to an end. But despite much interaction during this whole first temple period, there was no mass emigration to Egypt. At most, we have a trade delegation or a delegation of ambassadors, but we never had a full-fledged influx of Jews who settled there permanently. The first time a large group of Jews attempted to settle there was at the time shortly after the destruction of the first temple. If you'll notice on your handouts, we're about to quote the first paragraph A. And the setting of this passage is 2 months after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. Gedaliah ben Achikam, the governor of Yehuda that Nebuchadnezzar had appointed, was brutally murdered by an usurper. Despite the warnings of the prophet Yirmiyahu, to Jeremiah, the remnant of the Jewish community, afraid of reprisals by the Babylonians, and under the leadership of Yochanan ben Zechariah, decided to flee to Egypt. And this is what we read here in the first passage. This is taken from the Sefer Yirmiyahu, the book of Jeremiah, in chapter 43, and these are the verses 5 to 7. But Yochanan, the son of Zechariah, and all the captains of the forces took all the remnant of Yehuda, who had returned from all the nations where they'd been driven, to dwell in the land of Yehuda, and those people who had fled, and then after there was a Jewish governor installed, the Babylonians had taken into captivity all that they had decided to take, so the Jews that had fled, especially went north, decided things were safe, and they came south again. Men, women, and children, and the king's daughters, Zedekiah's daughters, and every person in Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had left. This was Nebuzaradan was the general who was the one who was the actual conqueror of Israel. All those who had left with Gedaliah, the son of Achikam, the son of Shaphan, and Yirmiyahu the prophet, and Baruch the son of Neriah, and Baruch ben Neriah was Yirmiyahu's disciple. And he, despite Yirmiyahu's warnings, this Yochanan ben Kareach led them to Egypt. So they came to the land of Egypt, for they obeyed not the voice of the Lord, and thus they came to Tachpanches. This was the capital of Egypt. While in Egypt, Yirmiyahu issued them the following warning that we have in paragraph B. The word that came to Yirmiyahu concerning all the men of Yehuda who dwell in the land of Egypt, who dwell at Migdol and at Tachpanches and at Noph, at this point they originally came to Tachpanches, the capital, but spread out. Noph was the city of Memphis, and in the country of Pathros, saying, "For I will punish those who dwell in the land of Egypt, as I have punished Jerusalem by the sword, by the famine, by the pestilence, so that none of the remnant of Yehuda who have gone to the land of Egypt to sojourn there shall escape or remain, that they should return to the land of Yehuda, to which they have a desire to return, to dwell there." In other words, those who left still had in their mind, who left and went down to Egypt, to hopefully come back and to go north to Eretz Yisrael. They were warned not to go, as we will see further on. And there's actually a prohibition to live in Egypt. And there was a specific prohibition that was uttered by the prophet, by Yirmiyahu. And for this reason, he said that they will be wiped out. "For none shall return but those who shall escape." The Seder Olam, This is a historic rabbinic midrash authored by Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, a disciple of Rabbi Akiva, states, in the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar, he conquered Egypt. Yirmiyahu and Baruch, his disciple, were exiled to Babylon. But it goes on to say, this is, I didn't translate it, but actually Egypt was ravaged and so was the Jewish community. This was the first time Jews settled. By the time of Alexander the Great, towards the end of the 4th century before the Common Era, Egypt was again resettled. This is what the Jewish historian Josephus writes about concerning the situation of the Jews in the capital city of Alexandria. It's on page 2, on paragraph A. But for Alexandria, the sedition of the people of the place against the Jews was perpetual. And this is what the cause was. From that very time when Alexander the Great, upon finding the readiness of the Jews in assisting him against the Egyptians, as a reward for such their assistance, gave them equal privileges in the city with the Grecians themselves. Evidently it would seem that Jews, when Alexander already conquered Egypt, it seems there were Jews already in Egypt. He established Alexandria as the capital city, but it seems there already was a populace of Jews who had re-inhabited this. Which honorary reward continued among them under his successors, who also set apart for them a particular place that they might live without being polluted by the Gentiles, and were therefore not so much intermixed with foreigners as before. They also gave them this farther privilege that they should be called Macedonians. In other words, they were actually called Greek citizens, or not Greeks, but they were given equal citizenship. Nay, Caesar, this is already at the time after the Roman conquest, nor any one that came after him thought of diminishing the honors which Alexander had bestowed on the Jews. But still conflicts perpetually arose with the Grecians, and although the governors did every day punish many of them, yet did the sedition grow worse. So Josephus describes the antiquity of this community, which evidently would seem resettled after the destruction of Nebuchadnezzar, the special rights they were given, and we have a sense of the hatred that the Grecian community, as the Greeks were the upper class in Egypt, had towards the Jews. The ranks of the first Jewish settlers were swelled by the influx of Jews that Ptolemy Soter, who was the successor of Alexander in Egypt, took for slaves when he invaded Eretz Yisrael. And this we find again from another passage in Josephus. The first passage was in the was taken from the Wars of the Jews, and now this is taken from his book Antiquities, which is a world, it's really, it goes the ancient history till his time. When Ptolemy Soter had taken a great many captives, both from the mountainous part of Judea and from the places about Jerusalem and Samaria, the places near Har Gerizim, where the Samaritan lived, he led them all into Egypt and settled them there. Nay, there were not a few other Jews who of their own accord went into Egypt as invited by the goodness of the soil and by the liberality of Ptolemy the First. Evidently after he had shown his strength, and it's not clear even from Josephus' account what was the cause of the attack. And in the book of Antiquities he describes this, that Ptolemy came without warning on Shabbos to Jerusalem. They opened the gates. They were not in any preparation for war. And he went and attacked the city. He killed some 10,000 people. Evidently afterwards he made his point. The Jews settled there who were not slaves, that were not touched. In a later quote, this was in the 11th book of Antiquities, in the 12th book, he goes on to describe when Alexander had reigned 12 years, and after him Ptolemy Soter 40 years, Philadelphus, who was the son of Ptolemy Soter, then took the kingdom of Egypt and held it 40 years within one. In other words, 39 years. He procured the Torah to be translated. He was the one who translated the Torah into Greek, and set free those that had come from Jerusalem into Egypt and were in slavery there, who numbered 120,000. Those As Josephus pointed out, despite the privileges the Jews had in Alexandria, there existed bitter hatred between the Greeks, the upper class of Egypt, and the Jews. In the year 38 of the Common Era, under the governorship of the Roman governor Flaccus, during the reign of the Roman emperor Caligula, this all erupted in what was to become a model for future pogroms in history. This is how the famous Jewish philosopher Philo, an eyewitness, described the events. And this is in paragraph D on page 2. From the four letters, this is the sections of the city, you know, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. So the Jews, by and large, lived in Delta. They ejected the Jews and drove them to herd in a very small part of one. This was Delta. The Jews were so numerous that they poured out over the beaches, dunghills, and tombs, robbed of all of their belongings. In other words, the Jews en masse, I mean, it's reminiscent of what happened under the Nazis. The Jews en masse were attacked and were deprived of all their belongings. A still more grievous evil than the pillaging was the unemployment produced. The tradespeople had lost their stocks, and no one, husbandsman, shipman, merchant, artisan, was allowed to practice his usual business. Thus, poverty was established in two ways. First, the pillaging, by which in the course of a single day they had become penniless, completely stripped of what they had, and secondly, their inability to make a living from their regular employments. They didn't want to hire them, and they had lost the tools of their trade. After the pillaging and eviction and violent expulsion from most parts of the city, the Jews were like beleaguered men with their enemies all around them. Poor wretches, they were at once seized by those who wielded the weapon of mob rule, treacherously stabbed, dragged through the whole city, and trampled on, thus completely made away with when not a part of them was left, which received the burial which was right of all. Some people were really torn apart. Indeed, whole families, husbands with their wives, infant children with their parents, were burnt in the heart of the city by those supremely ruthless men who showed no pity for old age nor youth, nor innocent years of childhood. This is how Philo described those events. But this was only the beginning. Less than 30 years later, in the year 66 of the Common Era, in the reign of Nero, and under the governorship of Tiberius Alexander, an apostate Jew and a nephew of Philo, another terrible slaughter occurred, perhaps eclipsing the horrors of the previous one. This is what Josephus wrote. But at this time, this is he writes in the Wars of the Jews, especially, this is the year 66, when there were tumults in other places, also disorders among them were put into greater flame. For when the Alexandrians had once had a public assembly to deliberate upon an ambassage where they were sending to Nero, a great number of Jews came flocking to the theater. When their adversaries saw them, and again, we're understanding the great anti-Semitism they were, they immediately cried out and called them their enemies, and they said they came as spies upon them, upon which they rushed out and laid violent hands upon them. As for the rest, they were slain as they ran away. But there were three men whom they caught and hauled them along in order to have them burnt alive. But all the Jews came in a body to defend them, who at first threw stones at the Grecians, but after that they took lamps and rushed with violence into the theater and threatened that they would burn the people to a man. And this they would have soon done unless Tiberius Alexander, the governor of the city, had restrained their passions. However, this man did not begin to teach them wisdom by arms, but sent among them privately some of the principal men, and thereby entreated them to be quiet and not provoke the Roman army against them. But the seditious made a jest of the entreaties of Tiberius and reproached him for so doing. Again, we have to realize when Josephus wrote this, and this was shortly after the wars, he wrote this in about the year 75, he was under the protectorship of the Roman Emperor Vespasian. When he wrote this work, in fact, he had it looked through before it was published, this Wars of the Jews, by Titus, who was actually the conqueror of Jerusalem, and by Agrippus, who was he was from the Herodian line, who was the titular head of Jerusalem at the time, even though he was an ally of the Romans.
So when we have this, which is a slant, is very pro-Roman, again, the problem with all of history is we only have only one source. He is our only source for these. But given that grain of salt, still we see, this is what occurred. Now when he perceived that those who were for innovations would not be pacified till some great calamity should overtake them, he made sure there would be a great calamity. He sent out, this is a Jew, by the way, who was the head, upon them those two Roman legions that were in the city, and together with them 5,000 other soldiers, who by chance were come together out of Libya to the ruin of the Jews. They were also permitted not only to kill them, but to plunder them what they had and set fire to their houses. These soldiers rushed violently into that part of the city which was called Delta. As again, there were four parts, so there's, you know, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, where the Jewish people lived together, and did as they were bidden, though not without bloodshed on their own side also. For the Jews got together and set those that were best armed among them in the forefront and made resistance for a great while. But once they gave back, they were destroyed unmercifully. And this, their destruction was complete, some being caught in the open field and others forced into their houses, which houses were first plundered of what was in them, then set on fire by the Romans. Where no mercy was shown of the infants, no regard had to the aged, but they went on to the slaughter of persons of every age until all the place was overflowed with blood, and 50,000 of them lay dead upon heaps. Nor had the remainder been preserved had they not betaken themselves to supplication. So Alexander commiserated their condition, and as it makes him like a Grisha Tzaddik, Alexander here, and gave orders to the Romans to retire. Accordingly, these being accustomed to obey orders, left off killing at the first intimation. But the populace of Alexandria, as the Greeks, bear so very great hatred to the Jews, it was difficult to recall them. It was a hard thing to make the Jews leave their dead bodies. So they were trying to protect them, and they were again being attacked not by the Romans, but by the Greeks. This happened in the period right before the destruction of the Second Temple. This tragedy was repeated again with awesome fury some 50 years later. In the reign of the Roman Emperor Trajan in the year 116 of the Common Era. It's quite instructive to read through the various sources to see both the extent of the destruction and the reason why the Jews would seem to were so cursed. At least this is the reason which is offered by the Midrashim, by the Talmud. Here on page 4, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai taught, in three places of the Torah we are warned not to return to Egypt. As it says, and it quotes them, for the Egyptians whom you have seen today, this is they were about to cross the Red Sea, you shall never see them again. And also shall henceforth return no more that way. And the Lord shall bring you into Egypt again with ships, describing the ultimate destruction of the Jewish nation. By the road by which I said to you, you shall see it no more again. And the Talmud understands that this is not just a promise, but this is a warning. Because I don't want you to be in Egypt again. Evidently, there's something with the place itself that the Torah itself does not want Jews to be there. On three occasions they returned, and on three occasions they fell. Once they returned in the days of Sanherib, this is referring to the mission that was sent, the ambassadors, the delegation that was sent in the days of Sanherib, the king of Assyria, and this was sent from the northern kingdom. And it says, woe is to those who go down to Egypt for help. What is written afterwards, now the Egyptians are men and not God. This is from the Navi, this is Yeshayahu, Isaiah. Not in their horses flesh and not spirit. When the Lord shall stretch out his hand, the helper shall stumble, and he who is helped shall fall down. They all shall perish together. And this is a prophecy describing the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. Once they Once they returned in the days of Yochanan ben Kareach, which we read before us. It says, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, indeed you set your faces to enter to Egypt and go to sojourn there, then it shall come to pass that the sword which you feared shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine of which you were afraid shall follow close after you there in Egypt, and there you shall die. It came to pass, this passage is in the Talmud Yerushalmi in the Tractate Sukkah. In the days of the wicked Trajan, that a boy was born to him on the 9th of Av while the Jews were fasting. His daughter died on Hanukkah, and the Jews were lighting lamps. His wife sent him a message saying, instead of conquering the barbarians, go and conquer the Jews. They've rebelled against you. She viewed the fast day at Trajan's Simcha, says, and the lighting of the lamps, the Simcha at Trajan's tragedy, as signs, really, of the Jewish attitude towards Trajan. He thought to arrive in less than 10 days, but he came in only 5. He came and found them engaged in the study of Torah, and it just happened to be they were studying the verse, God will lift up upon you, and this from the Teichacha, a nation from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies. He asked them, what are you engaged in? They replied, this is what we're learning. He said to them, I'm the man the scripture is referring to. I thought to come in 10 days, and I've arrived in only 5, like the proverbial eagle. He eventually surrounded them with legions and killed them. According to the historian Isaac Halevi, it wasn't Trajan himself, but it was a governor sent by Trajan. He then said to their wives, you had better heed the desires of my legions, so I won't have to kill you. First the men were killed, and we're going to describe from a medrash how that was. And there are Roman sources that corroborate this. They replied, when you've done to those on the ground, do as well to those above. And so their blood became mixed with their blood, and the blood went as far as Cyprus. And there's so many people that died, just went into the sea. At that time, the horn, the Karen of Israel, the pride of Israel was severed. It was not destined to return until the coming of the son of David. This is how the Talmud Bavli on page 5 describes, again, these events. And again, to give you a sense of what kind of a community lived in Alexandria. It was taught, Rabbi Yehuda says, he was not seeing the double colonnade of Alexandria in Egypt, had never seen the glory of Israel. It was said it was like a large basilica, one colonnade within another. You know, a colonnade is a group of pillars. And it sometimes held twice the number of people that went forth from Egypt. It held blocks and blocks. In other words, it housed over 1 million Jews. I mean, theoretically, if they all came to shul. There were in it 71 cathedras of gold. There were thrones of gold corresponding to 71 members of the great Sanhedrin. In other words, the leaders, or the Talmid HaChachamim, the scholars of the community, were seated up front in the synagogue on these thrones. Not one of them containing less than 21 talents of gold. And a wooden platform in the middle upon which the attendant of the synagogue stood with a scarf in his hand. It was a big shul. When the time came to answer Amen, he waved his scarf because no one could hear him. And all the congregation duly responded. They, moreover, did not occupy their seats indiscriminately, but goldsmiths sat separately, silversmiths separately, blacksmiths separately, metalworkers separately, weavers separately, so that when a poor man entered the place, he asked, where are the weavers? Where are the blacksmiths? He recognized the members of his craft, and applying to that quarter, obtained a livelihood for himself and the members of his family. Abaye stated, Trajan, the original text, we're going to get back to the end of the lecture, the original text read Alexander the Macedonian, the Macedon. But the Vilna Goin changes this text based on the text of the Talmud Yerushalmi that it was Trajan. And we know from Josephus, actually, Alexander was very good to the Jews. Trajan slew them all. Why were they so punished? And the Talmud understands, because they transgress this verse, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Those Jews should not live in Egypt. And they did return. And again, we're going to ask the question, well, if that's the case, how is it then years later, again, this is Egypt became a center of Jewry? This we'll touch upon in the end of the lecture. And when he came, he found them reading from the Torah. The Lord, again, will bring a nation against thee from afar. He remarked, I should have brought my ships in a 10-day journey, but a strong wind arose the ships. They arrived in 5 days. He saw it was an omen. It was a sign from heaven. He therefore fell upon them and slew them. On page 6, we quote from the Medrash Tana Devei Eliyahu that goes into great detail about how it was that they were destroyed. In the previous citations, and that we have from Philo and Josephus, the armies went into the Jewish quarters, you know, and attacked the Jews. How this happened was somewhat different. The original text reads Hadrian, but of course has to be changed. This is to Trajan. Trajan came and conquered Alexandria of Egypt. They had a population of 1,200,000. He deceived them by telling them, go out and stand in Bikas Yadayim. This nation, the Egyptian Greeks, should not dominate you. In other words, there was again constant, it would seem from this, again, that those poor relations, those terrible relations that existed between the Jews and the Greeks continued on. And the Romans said, you know what? If you have a fight over, don't do in the city. He says the army should go out, and you fight your men against the Greek men, whoever wins. They went out and stood in Bikas Yadayim, and they, the Romans, placed 50,000 troops with swords. In other words, then the Romans, who said they would have no part in this, put their men, says 50,000 troops is 10 legions, with swords in their hands behind them, and slaughtered them. So this was a trick. This was a ruse. They got them out, and then that's why the women were separated from the men. So that not one of them was left, as it stated, they spilled the blood like water. And again, then they went into the city, and then they killed the women. The sages said three rivers of blood flowed out from Bikas Yadayim and into the Mediterranean. The sages estimate the waters of the Mediterranean are found to be three parts blood to one part water. Some say that the Gentiles harvested their vineyards for 7 years using the Jewish blood instead of fertilizer. To give you a sense of what that community was, at least the little that we know of it, I quote, there's two citations here from the Talmud itself. One is, there's a Gemara, this is in Nida, this is Samach Tesomer Beis in the 69b. It describes that the community of Alexandria addressed 12 questions to Yeshua ben Hananiah, who was one of the foremost scholars of his time. It says three were of scientific nature, three were matters of agada, three were mere nonsense, they were inconsequential, and three were matters of conduct. And the Gemara is all sugya, so from there on to Daf Ayin in Nida, and it goes into details of what their questions were and what the answers were. In addition, we have in the next citation, paragraph J, from a Gemara in Ksubas in Chof Hei Amad Aleph in 25a, there's a question about knowing who is a true Kohen or not. What is the proof? Do we have proof or can it be supported? The person has a claim he's a Kohen, but what support is there? The fact is they go in front of the shul, they go in front of the synagogue, and they bless the duchen, they bless the congregation. Is that a proof? And it says it is. The letter is evidence, because the community who knows intimately who is who wouldn't let someone go up if he was not a proper Kohen. So if one brings to a court later, they witnesses, I saw him as Duchen, I saw him perform the blessings, that would be proof. But not taking a share at the threshing floors that would not be a proof. And Rishim Ben Gamliel says this would be in Babylonian Syria and Alexandrian Egypt formerly because there was a permanent court of law. In other words, at the time when Alexandria had this 1,200,000, there was a, it seems it was not, even though it's, we have from other sources it was a center of philosophy, but there was a permanent Beis Din there, and everything in all religious matters were conducted through the Beis Din, through the courts. So it was a very prominent community, and again, it was again destroyed. So we've gone through three, besides the small community that came in the time of Yirmiyahu at the end of the destruction of the first temple, but we find this is through in the time of Philo and Flaccus and the time of Josephus and the Tiberius Alexander, and again in the time of Trajan. This is the Jewish community here that was by Trajan was utterly destroyed. But again, there seems to have been, let's see, like a fatal attraction to Egypt. And even after this destruction, Jews again came back to Egypt. By Talmudic times, Alexandria once became a major Jewish center with a very large and prosperous Jewish population. Some estimate the number to be approximately 100,000. Christianity was then the official religion, and many of the early church fathers and scholars came from Egypt. The tensions that already long existed between the Jewish and non-Jewish communities was exacerbated by the new tensions created by Christianity. In the year 413, through the leadership of Saint Cyril, the Patriarch of Alexandria, one of the great historic church figures of the early church, the Jews were again murdered, plundered, and banished from their homes. By the way, if you're interested, his feast day is June 27th. You know? They have Kreset Tzadikim, these people. But somehow, after every setback, the community seemed to rise again. By the time of the conquest of Egypt by the Arabs in the year 640, Egypt again had a very large and prosperous Jewish community. And this right here in paragraph K on page 6, we read, and this is from Amir ibn Alas, who was the conqueror, who was the general who conquered Alexandria, and this is a letter that he sent to the Caliph Umar in the year 640. I've captured a city, Alexandria, from the description of which I shall refrain. Suffice it to say that I've seized therein 4,000 villas with 4,000 baths, 40,000 poll tax-paying Jews. Now, this was the Nadan, in other words, the baths, but there's 40,000 Jews who will pay taxes. Understand, the Jews are wealthy, and this is a common theme. You know, history keeps on repeating itself. The Jews are wealthy, and there are 40,000 who will pay taxes. And 400 places of entertainment for the royalty. So we rank pretty high, you know, with the baths and the villas, you know. During the Gaonic period, Egypt produced many great scholars. Rav Yitzchok Yisraeli, the great scholar and physician, was born in Egypt around the year 832. 50 years later, in the year 882, Rav Sadia Gaon was born in Fayum, south of Alexandria. By the time he left Egypt in the year 915, he was an accomplished Torah scholar, Hebraic scholar. Evidently, it would seem there were people of great stature who lived there from whom Rav Sadia took instruction, received instruction. Again, we don't know much about these people because they didn't write works, but evidently that such a person should have come out from Egypt is indicative of the status of that community. He went on later on, one of the works that Rav Sadia wrote was a siddur, which that siddur really encompassed the minhogim, the customs of what was the current way of prayer in Egypt. Egypt received a new infusion of scholarship in the 900s, with the arrival of Rav Shemariah ben Rebbe Chanan. And this is a theme that we've repeated several times. This is approximately the year 960 of the Common Era. And this quote is on page 7, which is taken from the Sefer HaKabbalah of the Ravid, Avram ibn Daud, of the 12th century. There was another cause as well for the decline of the yeshivas of the Gaonim, on page 7. There was an admiral of the Spanish fleet who came from Cordova by the name of Ibn Demahin, or in another version, this is Rumahis. The Arab king of Spain, Abd al-Rahman III al-Nasir, sent him to capture ships of Italian or Byzantine origin and to conquer cities near the border of Italy. They traveled to the shores of the land of Israel. This is trying to intercept boats. These are pirate ships. And turned around and headed towards the Aegean Sea, the Sea of Greece and its islands. They found a ship there. Amongst its passengers were four great scholars. They were traveling from the city of Bari. Bari is on the Adriatic coast, on the east coast of Italy, to a city called Sebastian. These scholars are going to a wedding. The language of the Ravid is Hachnasas Kala, or perhaps an alternate translation is to collect funds for the Kala, the twice-yearly conclave of scholars in Babylon. Ibn Ruhamis captured the ship and bound the scholars. One was Rav Hushiel, the father of Rabbeinu Hananel. Another was Rav Moshe, the father of Rav Chanoch. They bound him together with his wife and his son, Rav Chanoch, who was still a young boy. The third scholar was Rav Shmaryahu, Shmaryahu's ben Rav Elchanan. I don't know the identity of the fourth scholar. And he goes on to say that these scholars did not tell anyone what their true identity was, nor did they give any hint of their knowledge. The admiral sold them of Shmaryahu in Alexandria, Egypt. From them he went to the capital of Egypt, Fustat, and became the Rosh Hashiva. This was this Rosh Shmaryahu. Even though it would seem that Rav Elchanan and Rav Moshe were scholars, were Italian scholars, this Rav Shmaryahu, who disembarked from Italy, came from Italy, but it seems was originally a Babylonian scholar. Again, there's other historians question the validity of this letter, but this letter comes from the Cairo Geniza, and it says we paid attention. This is a letter from Rav Shrira Goin Rav Haigon, evidently to the community in Egypt. We paid attention to the praise which the Aluf, you know, this is the leader of the community, may the compassionate one protect him, gave to the Rav par excellence, our exalted one, our strength, Rabbeinu Shmaryahu. Evidently Rabbeinu is living in Egypt. This is a letter sent to Egypt. But he's called Roish Shuras Nahardo. It would seem that there was a row, there were seven rows of major scholars in the yeshiva of the Gaonim in Babylon. There were 10 scholars in each row. One row was called Shuras Nahardo. He was the leader of that row. Nahardo was a city at one time, was a major Torah center in Babylon, in our yeshiva. May our holiness strengthen him, help him, provide disciples for him, the son of Rabbeinu Elchanan of blessed memory, for he was the leader of this legislation. Evidently, Rabbeinu Elchanan was also, if he was not originally a Babylonian scholar, but he studied in Babylon, held a great position in Babylon. There are other sources which seem to indicate that this Rabbeinu Elchanan himself was a Rosh Hashiva before in Egypt. All those praises are true. We know of his praises more than anyone. Evidently, the community there had sent, you know, to send them of this Rabbeinu Shmaryahu. Evidently, he had just arrived. And he says, yeah, we know him. You know, there's no one like him from the rising of the sun to its setting. He was a lion of the company of scholars, and Arisha B'chabura, the greatest of the yeshivas, knowledge, his amazing insights, his wisdom, the chambers of his discernment, his questions and answers, his teaching, his power in Torah, was more than any of his colleagues. If this were not so, we wouldn't have appointed him to be a Mishnah. It's not clear what that position is. And we wouldn't have appointed him to the position of leadership, Roish, in one of the three most important rows in the yeshiva. Evidently, it must have been the third row. He is more worthy of praise than anyone. Also, his only son was with us in his very esteemed Mar Rav Ochanan, our colleague. Evidently, he sent his son to yeshiva in Babylon. So even though now he's in Egypt, he comes from a very prestigious line, and it seems his education was in Babylon. And he speaks about this Rav Ochanan, our colleague, which we appoint in our yeshiva. The son went in the footsteps of the father, also has an appointment, maybe not as high as the father's, but also had an appointment in the yeshiva. So it's a family of scholars. How he got to Italy, if his origins are from Egypt and Babylon, are not very clear. But we do know Italy was a major center of Torah. And it could very well be that he came there either to study, continue his studies there, or to teach there. He had a position there. I mean, it's just not clear why he was there. And again, much of history, unless we have a contemporary historian to tell us, is really bits and pieces that we have to put together. Egypt, besides having the merit of now, of we know had scholars that produced the stature of Rasadja Gaon, had now a Rosh Yeshiva there, who was of the highest stature, was also served as a communication center for the Gaonim and the Yeshivas of Babylon. And this is the quote on page 8. The questions from Spain, and this is taken from Simcha Asaf's work, Tkufas HaGaonim, the questions from Spain would be sent first to Keruan, and from there by caravan to Cairo, to Fustat. Cairo was a central way station for all of the... In Cairo, the special appointee of the yeshiva lived. At him personally went all of the questions and donations that were addressed to the yeshiva. He would send the responsa to Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, and Spain. When the response would come to Cairo, their scholars would copy them before they were sent out to their respective addresses. That is why the Geniza in Cairo became a repository for responsa addressed elsewhere. Because wherever it was sent, it was copied and then sent on. That's why it is the Cairo Geniza. To this day, Egypt serves as a place of teaching us Torah. Not only was Egypt a major center of Torah, but Egyptian Jewry had their own Reish Galusa, exilarch, a descendant of David HaMelech, as the head of the Jewish community. Before we go into greater detail regarding the Reish Galusa, the exilarch, his influence, to better understand the events that caused the Rambam to leave his native Spain and eventually arrive and settle in Egypt, it's important to have a better understanding of the Muslim world at the time. During the entire Gaonic era, the Muslim world went through constant wars, revolts, and religious upheavals. After the death of Ali, the husband of Muhammad's daughter Fatima, and the fourth recognized caliph, leader of Islam, in the year 661, the Muslim world began to split along religious lines. The majority, or Sunni, followed Muawiyah, the founder of the Umayyad dynasty. The Shiite Ali, the party of Ali, commonly known as the Shiites, refused to recognize Muawiyah. They maintained that only Ali's descendants, the children of Fatima, the grandchildren of Muhammad, were fit to hold the title of Caliph, the leader of Islam. Many bitter wars were fought to crush this Shiite opposition. As we explained in the previous lecture, there was a split amongst the Shiites as to which of Muhammad's descendants were fit to rule. The majority of Shiites today are Ithna Isharuya, or Twelvers. They believe that there were 12 legitimate caliphs, descendants of Muhammad. The last one of the 12 was supposed to have disappeared without a trace. According to Shiite legend, he never died, but will return one day as the Mahdi, the Muslim Moshiach, to redeem the faithful. Sounds familiar. The Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran was a twelver. There's another group of Shiites called the Zaidites, or fivers. They believe that there were only five legitimate caliphs, all of them, of course, descendants of Ali. They represent the Muslims in the northern mountainous area of Yemen. Yet another group of Shiites are the Sabiha, seveners. Listen, 12, 5, 7, you know. Or Ismailites. This sect originated after the death in 765 of the sixth Shiite Imam, Ja'far ibn Muhammad. Most Shiites accepted his younger son, Musa al-Kazim, as his successor. The Ismailis were those who supported his older disinherited son, Ismail. Their group lives today in Pakistan and in India. When we get to next year in the Crusades, the Assassins were part of this group. The Assassins who lived in the area of Afghanistan, who made terrible problems for everybody around them, were also seveners. The sect attained its greatest influence beginning in the year 908 when they conquered northern Africa. Kairouan became their capital. Their leader, Sayyid ibn Hussein, founded a dynasty that would last over 250 years. They are called Fatimids after Fatima, Muhammad's daughter, the wife of Ali. By the way, Sayyid ibn Hussein's personal physician was the great Jewish scholar of Yitzhak Yisraeli. By the year 914, the Fatimids had conquered Alexandria. Finally, in the year 969, a Fatimid army destroyed the remnants of the old regime and occupied the city of Fustat. Plans immediately were put into motion to create a new city for the Fatimid capital. They built it 3 miles north of Fustat, and they called it Al-Kahira, the Victorious. Today we call that city Cairo. The personal advisor of the Fatimid Caliph at that time of the complete conquest of Egypt was a Jew by the name of Rav Paltiel. He was a great philanthropist and supported the community in Eretz Yisrael. He was followed by his son, Rav Shmuel. During this period, the relations between the government and the Jews were very good. It was in this period that we have the following story that we quote on page 9. Here we have on page 9. In the year 366, AH is Anno, this is Hegira. So the Hegira, this is when Muhammad fled Mecca and went to Medina, 622, that's when their calendar began. So that's when the years began, which is 3,735 years from creation. There was a question of the Girsa here, and actually the text is either 985 or 975 CE. The queen came from Iraq to Egypt. Now, she was an Iraqi. She was from the royal house in Iraq, and she married the royal house in Egypt. The king told her that the Jews don't have a king or a prince. She replied to him, "In the kingdom of my father, there are many Jews, and they have a Nasi, as a prince, who is descended from the house of David. My father is blessed through them. If the thing is acceptable to the king, he should send a letter through his messengers." And then the king, the Egyptian king, asked the caliph of Iraq, "Send me one of the descendants of the house of David, for this is what your daughter desires." They sent him a wise and understanding person who was a direct descendant of the Nisim, of the princes, from the house of David. He appointed him over the land of Egypt, and from then on the position of Nogid began in Egypt. He had power through which the edict of the king of punishment and enforcement through the use of the cane and whip. This situation lasted until the time of the Rambam. Rav Yosef Sambri is the author of this account, a historian who lived in 17th century Egypt, seemed to equate the creation of the position of Nossi, the prince of the Davidic line, to the position of Nogid, the titular and powerful head of the community. This was not always the case. In other places besides Egypt, the Nogid was not necessarily the son of King David. Shmuel HaNogid in Granada, we covered in a previous lecture, he was a Levi. But they were nonetheless leaders of the community and influential core Jews. Rav Paltiel would be a model, as the one who was the close advisor to the Fatimid caliph, would be an example of this court Jew, a person who was a personal advisor, had tremendous influence, and was the leader of the Jewish community. It seems from the letter we're about to read on paragraph B that the influence of the Nogid was so great that the government itself often supported the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. And this is taken from this is on paragraph B. My brothers, you should know that the strain of the times are forcing us to prevail upon you for help. We normally wouldn't have asked you, although it is a merit for you to take part in our Torah studies. This is the community of Eretz Yisrael. The yeshiva at that time was in Ramla. And this is a letter sent to the community of Damiet, which is in the far eastern part of Egypt. This is in the deltas, the far eastern part. When we were supported by the government, we did not bother you with our needs. It is already 2 years since our brethren were punished by the Caliph al-Hakim. He was in 996 to 1020. He seems to have been really someone who was really deranged. And by the way, we'll touch upon it in another lecture. He was he is the patron saint. He is the founder of the Druze. In Israel, the Druze, this Caliph al-Hakim is their tzaddik. It is therefore impossible for us to ask for support from the government. So we're asking now from the support of the individual Jews in Egypt. But evidently the fact is the government supported the yeshivas is a tribute to the influence of these court Jews, those of the Nogid. By the middle of the 12th century, this is before the Rambam came to Egypt, in the year 1145, we find a Nogid by the name of Rav Shmuel HaNogid, not to be confused with Rav Shmuel HaNogid of Granada, who lived 100 years before. He was a contemporary of Yehuda HaLevi. He was in his honor of Yehuda Levi, who went from his native Spain attempting to go to Eretz Yisrael, which we discussed in the previous lecture, composed 9 poems in his honor. The Nogid, who was a court Jew, had to live near where the caliph, where the king lived, and that was in Cairo. But the first place Yehuda Levi came to was Alexandria. In writing a letter to excuse himself why he did not come directly to Cairo, in the bottom of page 9, he excused him, I thought to simply make Alexandria a shortcut on my way. I didn't plan to delay my carriage there. This was until I met he who was stronger than I, who serves as an appointee of my master. This is an amazing man of wisdom, the colleague, my master and teacher of Aaron Hadayan. In other words, there was a rabbinic judge who lived in the city of Alexandria, who when he first met him, says, Yehuda Levi couldn't leave the city. He was a person of such stature, he had to stay by him. There were many poems, in fact, of Yehuda Levi, created in this Rav Aaron, this Dayan's honor. His name was Rav Aaron Ben Tzion Elimani. And in a letter on page 10, describing him, he says, "My master and teacher of Aaron, the wonderful friend, the amazing judge, the chief officer, the teacher of ethics, the illustrious of colleagues, the leading speaker, the light of Torah and the brightness of logic, the pillar of Talmud and the support of Gomorrah." It would seem from the various correspondence and poems of Yehuda Levi that this was a man of tremendous stature. After Yehuda Levi, it seems, was a disciple of Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. He was a person who knew the Ri Magash, Rabbi Yosef Magash, who was the successor of Yitzchak Alfasi. He was a person who knew people of tremendous stature. Evidently, the fact is that he was so impressed by this Dayan as a tribute to the kind of people that lived in Egypt at the time. The Fatimids ruled in Egypt from 969 to 1171. That dynasty was finally overthrown by someone of Kurdish descent who was born in a town that was also Saddam Hussein's birthplace, the town of Tikrit in Iraq. As soon as he came to power, this new ruler returned Egypt to the Sunni, to the mainstream Orthodox Islam faith. His name was Saladin. His story and the story of the Crusades will be the subject of another lecture. But Saladin had a physician who served in his royal court, whose fame and lasting impact on the world, at least from a Jewish perspective, completely eclipsed that of his patient. His name was Rav Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides, the Rambam. The Rambam's story begins not in Egypt, but in Spain. His father, Rav Maimon, a disciple of the famer of Yosef Ibn Magash, was a dayan, a rabbinic judge in the city of Cordova. Rambam was born in the year 1035, or at least this is the commonly held date, 6 years before the death of Rav Yosef Ibn Magash. For many years, Spain had been in great turmoil. As we've noticed in the previous lecture, in the year 711, no identity to the other place, a united army of Muslim Arabs and Berbers, the natives of North Africa, wrested almost all of the Iberian Peninsula from the hands of the Christian Visigoths. The only area of Spain that was not conquered by the Arabs was the far north, chiefly the northwest province of Asturias. It was a very inhospitable land. It was mountainous, and they really didn't... It was difficult, the resistance was great, and the cost wasn't worth for them at the time conquering that part of the land. In retrospect, it was a terrible mistake. Because for the next 300 years, the Christians who were in that small corner kept on slowly gaining more and more power. But all in all, even though it was creeping, says the majority of that landmass, of the Iberian landmass, was under Muslim domination. But that unity began to fall apart in the beginning of the 11th century. Muslim Spain then began divided into 23 separate and often warring taifas, or city-states. This Muslim disunity laid the groundwork for the continuing Christian conquest of the Iberian Peninsula. Now they really made their way south, because now they weren't fighting a tremendous, united, large Muslim army, but really just an army that was recruited amongst 23 separate areas. By the year 1085, Alfonso VI of Castile had conquered the city of Toledo in central Spain. In other words, half of Spain was now in the hands of the Christians, afraid that all of Spain would eventually fall into their hands, because now they had a united army and they were going south. The Muslim potentates of southern Spain sent a united delegation to ask the Berbers of North Africa to come to their aid. Without waiting for a formal agreement, and as under what status they're coming, they just came. The Berbers poured into the Spanish peninsula. The two armies, Christians and Muslims clashed at a place called Zalaka on the 23rd of October in 1086. Jews fought on both sides. Legend has it that Alfonso asked the Berbers to halt their fighting on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to allow Muslims, Jews, and Christians to rest and not violate their respective Sabbaths. The Christian drive was halted. The Christians were defeated at Zalaka. And soon, all of Muslim Spain was united under the Berber dynasty, the Almoravids. In other words, after they took care of the Christians, they went and took, the Berbers took care of the little city-states and conquered them all. So now it became a single rule, which was really based in North Africa. And this was the Berber dynasty, Almoravids. They were fundamentalists. They were not basically, at least originally, they were not originally tolerant of the Jews. But eventually, through bribes and other means, there was a succession, a king died, a new king came. The Almoravids were eventually, by and large, tolerant of the Jews, and the Jewish community prospered. Like this is soon afterwards we find Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, coming from North Africa and now coming settling into Spain. It was in their reign that Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, Rabbi Yosef Migash, led the yeshiva in Lucina, Rabbi Moshe Ibn Ezra and Rehuda Levi wrote their poetry and works of philosophy. This was all under the Almoravids. The Almoravids, in turn, were conquered by another Berber dynasty, the Almohads, or the Unitarians. Founded by a fundamentalist Muslim teacher, Muhammad ibn Tumart, who declared himself Mahdi, like Mashiach, and Sinlas Imam, which is also very familiar, he died in the year 1129. His successor, Abd al-Mumin, after 18 years of bitter fighting, conquered the Almoravid capital, Marrakesh, in 1147. And began a dynasty that would last in some form for over 100 years. One of the chief features of the Almohad reign was their complete religious intolerance. Jews were given the choice of conversion to Islam or exile. They were lucky when it was exile. Usually it was either Islam or death. I'd like to read to you Rav Avram ibn Daud, the Ravid's account of the impact of the Almohad invasion. And he says here in the bottom page 10, after the passing of Yosef HaLevi, the world became bereft of yeshivas and the source of wisdom. And then there was no one like him. Even though Rav Meir, his son, and Rav Meir, his nephew, were his disciples, received his traditions, were immense scholars who should have inherited his mantle, the tzaddik Rav Yosef died right before the beginning of terrible times. After the passing of Yosef HaLevi, there were years of hostilities, decrees, and enforced conversion of Jews. The population left and went into exile. Those who were for death, paraphrasing a pasuk in Tanakh, those who were for death to death, those for the sword to the sword, those for famine to famine, those who were for captivity to the captivity. There was something there was worse than the prophecy of Jeremiah. Those who were for apostasy to become apostates. This was due to the sword of Ibn Tamuras, he was the founder of the dynasty, who went forth to wreak havoc on the world in the year 1142. He has the date 1142. We have from regular historic sources that actually the year was 1147 that they went up and conquered. But it could very well be that what we're seeing here that was really before the conquest, perhaps, were other problems that developed, or there were attempts of conquest before. And decreed to force Jews to leave the community of faith. They said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. The name of Israel may no longer be remembered. And so it was. No remnant of the Jewish people remained in all of the kingdom of Tsala, at one end of the world until Almadia. I mean, these are the cities that cross one end of southern Spain to the other. Because of this, the sons of Rav Yosef could not establish yeshivas. Evidently, it seemed to be early on after his death. It happened, at least according to the account of the Ravid. Rather, went into exile to the city of Toledo, which we said before had been already captured by Alfonso and was a Christian city. There they tried to establish disciples to the best of their ability. The Holy One blessed me. He approved of their actions and helped them. These scholars represent the last of the sages of the Talmud in our times. We know from other sources when these Berbers came, the Almohads, they destroyed every vestige of Jewish life. They destroyed every shul. Like there was no synagogue left. And of course they could not, no Jews were allowed to practice Judaism. It seems many converted, many were killed, al Kiddush Hashem, and many fled. It was then that Rav Maimon was forced to leave Cordova and wander for many years, it seems, in northern Spain, which was under more tolerant Christian rule. His story, and the story of his famous son, Rav Moshe ben Maimon, is the subject of our next lecture. But I'd like now to conclude this lecture with analysis of the problem which we alluded to before. How were Jews allowed to live in Egypt? Although we previously touched upon the prohibition, I'd like to touch upon the circumstances which one is allowed to live in Egypt. And this is on page 11. And this is taken from the Yerushalmi, in the Sanhedrin. This is in chapter 10 in Halacha. This is a test, Halacha 9. You shall henceforth return no more that way, which is understood by the Talmud is not as a prophecy, as a prohibition. But he says you can't go there to dwell. For the purpose of dwelling you shall not return. You may return, however, for the purpose of doing business with the Egyptians, is to sell wares, or to purchase merchandise, or to conquer the land. In other words, Egypt could be an adjunct of Israel at that point. As a greater Israel, they could live there. But as a separate entity, they were not allowed to live there permanently. And the Rambam quotes this. This is the Rambam. The Maimonides brings this in the Sefer HaMitzvot, Nechus Melochim. And again, the problem is then, what is the heter? What is the, by what basis, you know, did Orthodox Jews live in Egypt, those who practice the Torah? We quote here, this is some much discussion. I just want to give you a sense of the various ways that this problem was attempted to be solved, and each one has its difficulties. This is given by the Ritva. Ritva was a major, one of the major Talmudic scholars in 14th century Spain, in Seville. In his comment about Alexandria, this is taken from the Gemara in Yoma in 38a, about the community of Alexandria. There was a story there that the gates in the front on the eastern part of the temple courtyard were originally taken, says, by were acquired in Alexandria, and that's because of the workmanship, and they were bought there and they were transported to Yerushalayim to be put into the temple. So he explains, as they explained in the Sifri, so there was no problem of going there to purchase goods. For the purpose of dwelling, you should not return. You may return for the purpose of doing business or to conquer the land. However, it is perplexing, so that we understand why the gates of the Beis HaMikdash were allowed to be bought in Egypt, because you can go down there temporarily to do business. But how it is perplexing is that how the Jewish world has justified itself in our own days to dwell in Egypt. In the Ritva's days, it was a major Jewish community. For instance, as in the case of the Rambam, blessed memory, and many other great men. Now he begins to offer various hypotheses and theories. There are those who say that those original cities have already become mixed with foreigners, or they become desolate, and the present cities are actually not the original ones, were settled by different peoples, it seems, afterwards. In other words, it's a problem of Egyptians and not the land of Egypt. So according to the world, there are different people. They're not the original Egyptians. a major problem is, as we're going to, is there were other peoples there in the time when we describe the when the Greeks and the Romans lived there, you know, and the Flaccus and all this whole period when it was in the time of the temple and the time when it was destroyed by Trajan. It's not clear, but it wouldn't seem, at least on the surface, that the Arabic conquest of Egypt made such a tremendous change. I mean, the populace was still there. They converted to Islam. There were Arabs who moved there and again became the elite. But they were, the Coptic church was really the old Egyptians is still there. I mean, they're, because of the persecution they had, they lost many members, but there's still an Egyptian church till this day. And the members, of the, especially in southern Egypt, they are either pure Egyptians of a mixed blood of Arabs and Egyptians. I mean, just as before, it says by the Greeks. To say that these cities are the old ones left, the new ones are here, has difficulties. Rabbi Eliezer of Metz answered the problem by saying the scripture only forbade going back over the same road from Eretz Yisrael via the desert to Egypt. This is based on the wording, you shall henceforth return no more that way. And it would seem then, and according to this interpretation, well, the problem is going the land route. The problem is not so much living in Egypt, but leaving Israel and going back. The problem here is, in another verse, which we've quoted before, it seems that you're not allowed to go by ships either. And as this last, at the end of the Toichacha, at the end of the curses given the Torah, it says that the Jews will finally be brought back to Egypt in ships via the way they came. And they will go onto the slave market, but no one will want to buy them. Which, by the way, Rav Isaac Halevi quotes a German historian from quoting ancient sources. He says, after the defeat of Betar, this is around the year 135, the Jews who were not sold, and the surviving Jews who were not sold in the slave markets in Gaza were taken by ship to Egypt, to Alexandria, were put on the slave block to be sold. But the Egyptians hated the Jews so much that they attacked them and killed every single one of them. And this is how he views the Vizigal looking at it. This was the fulfillment. This is the last sentence of the Toichacha, of the curses to the Jews. But it seems you can take not the land route, you can take the ship route. But at least there are those who say it that way. This would not give an answer, though, to the Rambam, because we know, and we're going, this is the next lecture, that he went eventually from Spain to North Africa to Eretz Yisrael, and he was in Israel for several months, and then from there he went from Israel to Egypt. The most correct explanation is that prohibition was only in effect, as Ridvo says, as long as Jews were dwelling on their land. In our times, however, when we are condemned to be dispersed throughout all the corners of the world, all the land outside of Israel has one status. The only prohibition is to willfully leave Eretz Yisrael to go abroad. The problem, of course, with that is, and that would be a beautiful answer for everything, but again, that story that we have of Trajan, you know, of the destroying the Jewish community in the year 116, and all the Midrashim point that the reason was that the Jews should not have lived in Egypt in the first place, took place 50 years, you know, after almost 50 years of destruction of the temple. I mean, the Jews are already well dispersed then. It could be that the Ritva's text read Alexander, as we said in the Talmud Bavli in the Babylon, and not Trajan. But as we point to Vilna Gaon changes the text to Trajan, that is the text in the Talmud Yerushalmi. And if that's the case, again, we know from other historical sources it happened. The Jews lived there at that time and were destroyed at that time. And again, so if that's the case, again, So we find that there was even in dispersion, the Jews are not allowed to live there. So again, it creates a problem. In conclusion, I'd like to quote from Rav Shtori HaParchi in his work Kafter of Aferach. Rav Shtori HaParchi was a scholar from Provence in southern France, who left France when the Jews were expelled in the year 1306 and subsequently settled in Spain. Eventually, he has made his way to Eretz Yisrael, where he wrote his classic work Kafter of Aferach on the laws and the boundaries and identification of the cities of Eretz Yisrael. And this is what he writes is on the top of page 12, the end of your notes. In Egypt, I have heard from Rav Shmuel of blessed memory, one of the grandchildren of Rambam of blessed memory, that Rambam would sign his signature, he would preface it with a phrase, "the undersigned who violates three prohibitions every day." In other words, I should not be living here in Egypt. Three prohibitions, as we quoted before, three times the Torah stressed Jews should not be living in Egypt. I wanted to console him and told him that perhaps Rambam Zal was forced to be in Egypt because he was the personal doctor to the king of Egypt. He couldn't leave. That maybe would be a reason why he couldn't leave, but that's not a reason why he came and why he was there many years before he became doctor and the chief physician. It's in all probability, as again we're going to be discussing the situation as it was in the next lecture of the Arab world, it could very well be that the Jews in Egypt, at least originally when there, had no choice. This was the only place that would take them. There were a threat of death to perform the world was a very inhospitable place. Eretz Yisrael was a place of war. The Jews, it was very hard for Jews. It was a small group of Jews who lived in Akko, which was the last remnant of the Latin kingdom, in other words, of the Crusaders. It was a very difficult place to live. It was very dangerous. Morocco, says Algiers, Tunisia, didn't allow Jews to practice Judaism. So it could very well be that it was there, basically, there were not many choices, and under those circumstances, perhaps, you're not required to risk your life, or to risk the practice of Judaism as a whole to live in any other land. But of course, this may justify that period of time. One has to, this is in a later period, again, there was a prosperous Jewish community. One has to know why, again, was their justification. Perhaps they relied on the Ritva already. But again, it would seem if our text, the text of the Yerushalmi, and we have from other historic information, that actually the Egyptian community was destroyed some 50 years after the destruction of the temple, and the Jews are already in dispersion. It's very difficult to understand then what was the real basis then. The Jews were allowed to, and it was destroyed because they were not allowed to live in Egypt. So, if you come up with a better answer, I'm willing to hear. Jeremiah, the question of Jeremiah going down, he was told to go to Egypt with them. I mean, that was part of his prophecy. A nevuah is a little different, you know. I mean, he came down there as it was under very different circumstances. It could also very well be, and again, it was just very hard to know. I mean, he came down, he was told to go down there. He could also be there when all the Jews left Egypt en masse. And I don't know, I'm just theorizing. For him to be alone in Eretz Yisrael was truly a sakana. Was a danger. When the Jews were there as a community, there was something else. And even the Babylonians, he promised them, basically, the Babylonians come, you're not at fault for killing Gedaliah ben Achikam. And perhaps he would say that they would appoint another governor and give them the... but he is a lone Jew, or with his Talmud Baruch Ben Neriah, alone in Israel. Could be that it was, I don't know, but that itself would be a sakana, which would warrant he would have, he as an individual would have the right to leave. Yeah, but, you know, he's a Navi, so he's a prophet, so it's a different... What? Well, again, he was directed as a prophet to go, but I think he was there to tell them to leave. You know, that was his job. So he was down there to tell them the dire consequences of leaving. That's how he was directed to go down there. It's hard to know about these things. It could very well be it includes men, women, and children.
But I mean that the number of 2 million is not
Joseph
trying to say how large it was,
just
picking a number.
Yeah, but the number 1,200,000 could represent not males, and it represents like the entire community, everybody. It could very well be. So I'm not sure. You know, it's hard to know. Any other question? Well, yeah, he was only there temporarily, you know. Well, he... Yeah, well... He was a prime example, yeah. What is so bad about Egypt? When we deal with the... trying to find the rationale of mitzvahs, we're on very shaky ground. We can deal with it as a legal system. I mean, it's like dealing with physics. I mean, to deal with whys is very difficult. I can deal with whats. I can describe what it is. I can, using the laws, I'll predict future, I'll extrapolate and predict future events. But to say why does gravity exist? Why does so? It just we're on very slippery ground. Yeah. It would seem though that there's a Gemara in Kedusha and Memtes Amud Beis describing about different things were given to different gifts were given to different places. Beauty was given to Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael. Wisdom to Eretz Yisrael. Witchcraft, Tuma, was given to Egypt. So if that's the place, you know, if that's the place on earth that produces it, it's better not to be there, you know. Perhaps that's really right. The quote is in the Gemara that he gave. It's really he gave to the B'nai Keturah. I mean, it says the B'nai Pelagshim, or maybe includes Yishmol or doesn't include Yishmol, but to the children of his concubines he gave matonas. He gave gifts, which the Talmud interprets as shem kshafim, the names of kishuf. He gave, you know, this the name of witchcraft. And see these. The power and the secret he gave them. But they were not the major practitioners. Maybe they would... I mean, this, of course, would be based... I mean, it really only makes sense, and the commentators speak about, if we maintain that non-Jews are not commanded, they're not part of the Noahide laws, they're not prohibited from practicing witchcraft. And assuming that... But they were never the major practitioners. The major practitioners were the Egyptians. No. Not the original Egyptians are not descendants of Ishmael. Perhaps, again, the intermixing is in the 7th century after the Arab conquest. There was some intermixing of Arab blood because the resettling of Arab blood with Egyptian blood. But by and large, they're their own people, the Egyptians. Yeah, the Arabs are a conglomeration. Today's Arabs, unless the Arabs probably in Saudi Arabia, which are pretty much self... But the Arabs all around, what we call Arab, are really Arabic-speaking people. They may have some, but they are really an intermixture of Greeks, of all kinds of different peoples, the indigenous people of the place. And there's an admixture of also of the Arab blood together. But we call them Arabs in terms of that they speak, because they speak Arabic, and by and large their culture is Arabic and their religion is Islam.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.